The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of any organization, including One Generation Away.
The freedom of a people to choose its leaders is the root of liberty.
Keep alive this experiment in liberty.
Liberty, in case you've forgotten, is the soul's right to breathe.
Government should be very minimal in protecting liberty.
Peace cannot be purchased at the cost of liberty.
The sturdy ground of liberty.
Liberty once lost is lost forever.
Fight for their liberty and for our security.
Guarantees individual liberty.
This great republic born alone in liberty.
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 Just how much do you want liberty?
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner. Cutting through the double talk, taking on the topics, going after what the politicians really mean, and making it all clear. For your freedom and your liberty. Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
What happened to Hillary Clinton and the Democrats in that fateful year of 2016? Why and how did Hillary Clinton lose a race they said she couldn't possibly lose? We'll talk about it with a woman who watched it all unfold as head of the Democratic National Committee, Donna Brazil. Welcome back into Liberty Nation. Today, the two-time chair of the DNC who sat often helplessly watching the slow drip of defeat day by day envelop a Clinton campaign that had seized control of the DNC Donna Brazil was now supposed to head. We'll talk through a number of things, past, present, and future. Sexual misconduct in high and mighty places touching the face of NBC, Matt Lauer, this week. And as this unfolding and devastating narrative develops into the story of the year, we'll be joined by Lisa K. Donner, editorial director at LibertyNation.com, to discuss her own experience in the media and with politicians, and she's got a story to tell. So, how would you like to be thrust into a leadership role through no choice of your own, where you have little to gain and everything to lose in the midst of scandal caused by other people and through no fault of your own, with the most powerful position in the world at stake? Well, that was the situation facing the woman who joins us today, Donna Brazil, widely respected Democrat strategist for over 30 years, who took over as chair of the Democratic National Committee for a second time after her predecessor, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, was forced out under a cloud of scandal, and just as Hillary Clinton was about to become the Democrat nominee for president. And Donna's written all about it in her page-turner of a book entitled Hacks, the Inside Story of the Break-ins and Breakdowns That Put Donald Trump in the White House. A very personal story of how she endured the drama and scandals and hacking of a uniquely bitter and draining and ultimately failed presidential campaign, and a story that has stirred a great deal of controversy over these last weeks. Donna, welcome on board. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thank you. It's great to hear your voice also.
Oh, I appreciate it. Now, you and I met, you know, just as the first excerpts of your book were being released and you were preparing for the slings and arrows from your fellow Democrats that were sure to follow and did. But I've followed your career for a long time, from your work with Jesse Jackson in the 80s to heading up the Gore for President campaign in 2000 to where we are today. And one thing that always stood out was that even though you're a lifelong Democrat strategist, high-ranking Democrat strategist, you seem to be not just respected but liked by a lot of people around Washington, including conservatives. Now, let me ask you this. How can we return to the point where, like with you, people can discourse with their political opponents in a civil manner again? Or are we so bitterly divided that we're past the point where that can even happen again?
Well, first of all, again, I want to just say thank you for having me on your show, and I respect your voice as well. I have been around a long, long time. I came up at a time in American politics when you saw a lot of bipartisan cooperation, a lot of bipartisan friendships. I remember when Tip O'Neill told me I was a kid, after bringing 7 million signatures up to Capitol Hill to designate January 15th is Dr. King's birthday. He said, now, you know, I'm going to have to go and talk to Ronald Reagan. Almost a few months later, I was in the White House with Tip O'Neill, Ronald Reagan, and I saw the King Holiday Bill signed into law. From that moment forward, I've always believed that you cannot just basically cut off anybody simply because they are in the opposing party, opposing gender, opposing race, whatever. We are God's children. We are created in a way in which we must learn how to love each other and listen to each other. I have learned so much over the years, not just from my friends who are progressive or liberals, but also my friends who are conservative. I would not be the person I am today if I didn't have friends from across the board, across all political bandwidth. And as long as they believe in our basic values as Americans, and I think we all do share those basic common sense, common decency values, then I want to listen to people. I want to listen to George Will. I want to listen to Laura Ingraham. But I also want the George Wills and the Laura Ingrahams and the Sean Hannitys to listen and learn from the Donna Brazils of the world as well. We have a lot to learn from each other, and I have a lot to learn from you, and I've been reading up about you as well, so I want to thank you for your service as well.
Well, thank you so much. I'm delighted to hear that you're reading some of our stuff at Liberty Nation. Let's talk about your book, because it really is a page-turner. I could barely put it down. You talk a lot about the Hillary Clinton campaign as a soulless enterprise driven almost entirely by data and an evacuated of personality, a campaign which essentially took over the Democratic National Committee a year before the nominee was selected and shut you out. Now, you write that no one was to breathe or move unless Brooklyn okayed it, Brooklyn being the home of Clinton headquarters. Brooklyn didn't want anyone who could second guess them. Everyone in the Clinton leadership worshiped the data and the analytics, while you've always relied on feel and touch and instinct. And that you wrote that the campaign was marked by self-satisfaction and inevitability. Now, I don't want to relitigate this whole thing because you've been talking about it for some time. But let me ask you this. After Barack Obama's brilliant use of data in his two campaigns, data became the big thing. Now, do you think the failure of the data in the Clinton campaign will return the party back to being more personal and less computer driven?
Well, you know, data, there's a great deal we can learn from data and algorithms and learning about voter habits and preferences. But there's no substitute, as you well know, from actually talking to people, getting to understand their views, their values, and to cater a campaign strategy simply to seeing numbers and analytics and not knowing that Mr. Joe down the street or Miss Mary around the corner are the driving force and persuading people to vote, persuading people to get involved, persuading people, period, because they are part of the neighborhood, part of the community. The Obama campaign was quite organic. It was organic in the sense that everyone felt like they could make a difference. In this campaign, it was almost as if asking for a poster or a yard sign felt like you were creating mutiny. Like, why do you need that? Well, of course you want some signs of visibility, because visibility is viability. And so throughout the term that I serve as chair, I wanted the campaign to recognize that in addition to the data and analytics, we needed stuff on the ground. We needed people to feel excited. And the only way to get that excitement was to really engage people where they live, where they work, where they play, like go to bowling alley, go to games, and, of course, where they pray. And those are the fundamental things that I've learned about politics throughout my 40-plus years working across the country.
We are joined by Donna Brazil. And, Donna, a lot of people, honestly, myself among them, think that the ultimate purpose of your book, outside of setting the record straight and telling your own story, is to convince the party that it's time to once and for all move beyond the Clintons. Was that the message of your book?
No, I don't think my message was about elimination or subtraction. My book was really about the hacking of our democracy. And it was my story because I was chair of the party. I became chair for the second time in my adult life because of the hacking. And it's the inside story of the break-ins and breakdown that put Donald Trump in the White House. And I wanted the American people to come away understanding that the hacking of our election is reason for us to come together as a country to avoid this from happening again. This time there was a severe attempt to hack into our election process. What if someone, another country, tried to hack into our infrastructure, our electrical grid? Hacking is important. Cybersecurity is something that concerns not just major corporations, but it concerns universities, academia, and the media. So I also believe that part of my story is to talk about the hacking. Clearly, the Democratic Party has a large bench of people who will possibly run in 2020. I don't know all of the candidates, but I'm sure that there are so many people out there who will continue to support Secretary Clinton. She has a lifelong service inside the Democratic Party, and I would hope that whatever her future is, that those who support her and those who may never support her will understand that she is a woman of valor, a woman of courage, and she has served our great nation.
Donna Brazil, her book is Hacks, the Inside Story of the Break-ins and Breakdowns that Put Donald Trump in the White House. We talked about a lot of other stuff, which we'll play for you later on in the show, including whether it's time for Hillary to just leave the stage, what direction the directionless Democrat Party is headed, and whether she would support an impeachment effort if the Democrats win control of the House next year. But up next, sexual misconduct has become a plague on the land with Matt Lauer, the latest giant in his field to get taken down. We'll talk about it with LibertyNation.com editorial director Lisa K. Donner.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
We have heard here today has been a political spectacle.
We elect these guys to run the country. They're just not doing their job.
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Sexual misconduct. It's all over the headlines these days. In fact, I believe it will be, if it isn't already, the story of the year, the narrative which will be most remembered from 2017, even more than the start of the once-in-the-lifetime presidency of Donald Trump. And joining us to discuss how to sort all of this out and talk about her own experiences in and around the media for over 35 years is LibertyNation.com editorial director Lisa K. Donner, who doubles as my wife in her spare time. And she wrote about the fall of Matt Lauer this week, among other things. Welcome, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tim. Good to be here.
Appreciate it. Now, in the media, we see this with Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose and Mark Halperin and Glenn Thrush and Roger Ailes. And in Hollywood, there's Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey and Louis C.K., who apparently is famous, though I'd never heard of him before, this whole dust-up. And in politics, there's Roy Moore and there's John Conyers and Al Franken. Everybody believes the list will go on and on eventually. Let's talk about the media and politicians, because you worked in TV as a reporter and an anchor and producer in four major markets, Boston and Pittsburgh and Charlotte and Washington. Are the kind of things you're hearing about these alleged sexual miscreants consistent with what you've experienced around other members of the media and politicians over the years?
Absolutely. This is nothing new. I think this has been going on for many, many years. It's just out there now. In terms of who's doing what, I always saw it in terms of the amount of power a man had over a woman. In other words, the more power he had, the more likely he was to use his influence to create negative sexual situations. I remember being a very, very young reporter and having a one-on-one interview with a major politician who has passed away now, who was very famous in Massachusetts. You can put the pieces together yourself. I won't speak ill of the dead, but let me say that for that 20-minute one-on-one interview. He never made eye contact once with me. He had held the whole interview staring at my chest. And
maybe he just liked your dress.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, I was very young, and it was unnerving. But I've met members of the media who were just as creepy. But I think it really has to do with the amount of power a man has.
But you also experienced this kind of, I mean, that was mild compared to what you experienced in the workplace from your boss.
Yes, I had an experience early on that was rather evocative of Cokie Roberts and her comment this week. Do you have that, and can you play that?
Okay, here's what Cokie Roberts said, and she's talking here about John Conyers, who has been accused of some really creepy sexual stuff over a long period of time. He's 88 years old. There's questions about whether he's still, shall we say, compos mentis. What Cokie Roberts is saying here is that the exploits of John Conyers were a very open secret for a long time.
The fact that people are willing to be public can change things. I mean, we all talked about for years.
A little bit at a time.
Well, you know, don't get in the elevator with him, you know, and the whole, every female in the press corps knew that, right? Don't get in the elevator with him. Now people are saying it out loud.
That's so funny because I was so young and naive. I remember getting in the elevator once in my first broadcasting job with a general manager. And before I knew it, he had me pinned against the back of the elevator with his tongue down my throat. And I found it rather jarring. But at the same time, I didn't quit. I didn't talk about it. I just moved on. And I'm not saying that's the way to handle it. But, you know, at 22 years old, that's how I chose to handle it. But in his case, it was shocking. It was surprising. I thought he was a very upright and proper man, and I was shocked to be pinned against the back of the elevator. I didn't realize that elevators were a common place for
closed,
such things.
A closed environment.
Yeah.
It makes total sense. Okay, now let's broaden this discussion a little bit. Given that the preponderance, certainly not all, but the preponderance of sexual misconduct allegations have been made against leftists, Lauer, Rose, Halperin, Weinstein, Spacey, Louis C.K., Conyers, Franken, do you sense that the reaction of ordinary Americans will revolve more around the sexual misconduct or more about around the hypocrisy of these leftists who claim to be down with the cause of feminism?
To me, it's the former rather than the latter. I don't think that people are looking at people's politics when it comes out about sexual allegations. I think that most women think a pervert is a pervert or is a pervert, whether he's a Republican pervert or a libertarian pervert or a Democrat pervert.
They're equal opportunity perverts.
Yeah, I don't really see it as a political issue, and I don't think they're putting up ticks, you know, five on this side and two on this side. I think this has always been going on. I mean, look at Harvey Weinstein and the whole business with him. This was going on for many, many years. And I think it started many, many years before Harvey Weinstein. In other words, the casting couch is famous because it's the casting couch. Everybody knows what goes on there.
Thanks for your perspective. Appreciate it. Lisa K. Donner. Quick break and then back with the second part of our discussion with former chair of the Democratic National Committee, Donna Brazil.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
What we have heard here today has been a political spectacle.
We elect these guys to run the country. They're just not doing their job.
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
We continue now with our discussion with Donna Brazil, two-time chair of the Democratic National Committee and strategist extraordinaire. I asked her if Hillary should still be out there on the stage or if she should leave the stage and allow other younger Democrat voices to carry the fight against President Trump and the Republicans.
Well, the stage is large, and as you well know, we need people. We need many voices out on the stage, and it's not just a stage that we need to talk about President Trump. As I mentioned to people all over the country, I pray for our president. He's our president. We have one president at a time, and as long as I have breath in my body, I will always pray for the president of the United States, regardless of whether or not I supported him or her in the future. Saying that, I mean, we as Americans need to understand we need more people to run for office. We need more public servants. I mean, today as we speak, there are so many news stories now about sexual harassment. We need more people to run for office, and hopefully in the future we'll see more women run for office. We'll see more people of color. I don't know if you intend to run for office. Again, you've run once for the United States Senate, but you know what? We need more voices out there.
Well, I mean, I appreciate your words, and I think that it's really true. But, of course, part of what you write about in the book, and I wanted to just to add to something that you said much earlier, you talk a lot in the book about the personal anguish of being hacked day after day after day and not knowing where the next attack was to come from. I mean, it was really a heartbreaking personal tale, no matter what your political affiliation is.
It's a form of harassment. It's people prying into your life as if they know you when they don't know you. What they know is some aspects of your life, but not the entire picture. But because they have your identity, they've stolen your identity, they've stolen your emails, they possess stuff that should not be in the public domain. They prey upon you in ways that feels as though they're going to come after you. And from time to time, I didn't have a good sense. Remember, one of our staff members was murdered, and there was a lot of concern that our own personal safety was something that we had to pay attention to. And I took careful steps, not just in my personal life, but also as party chair, to protect the staffers and the infrastructure of the Democratic National Committee. And, you know, every time we were hacked, we knew that the Russians were still coming after us. I picked up the phone and I called or text over to the RNC. I felt as an American it was my duty. I was no longer a partisan. I felt it was my duty to not just alert, you know, federal officials, which we did, but it was also my duty to alert the Republican National Committee. Because here in America, if you destroy one political party, you believe you're left with another. But if you destroy both political parties, then what do we have in our democracy? I mean, so I was quite concerned, and I would hope as we focus on 2018 that we take this seriously and that we begin to try to prevent it. What if it's North Korea next time? What if it's Iran? What if it's another nation that is trying to destroy our democracy? Our founders, those men and, of course, so many women who were in the shadows, they would want us to protect our democracies, to protect our freedom. And we have to focus on that. That is the goal of my book as well.
You know, just listening to you again today, this is the type of approach, maybe the only approach, exactly the kind of things you're talking about that can bring us back to some semblance of reconciliation. So let me ask you this. In recent years, you know, we've seen other major political strategists like Terry McAuliffe and Ed Gillespie running for office. Now, given your personal popularity both in D.C. and back in your beloved home of Louisiana, and the fact that you've always been a battler who seems to have more battles left in you, are you planning to run for office?
You know, I've never had that that passion inside of me to put my own hat in the ring or my gloves. But I've had a passion to recruit the next generation. I am so excited about the young people that I'm engaged with every day while on campus here or on campuses across the country. So I'm going to be one of those Americans that look for the next generation of leaders. My students come from all backgrounds, all walks of life. I have Republicans, Democrats, and everything in between. They're the future of our country, the future of our democracy. My job is to help them find their seats at the table.
So the Democratic Party, Donna, is at a crossroads. They can go from this position of being in a severe minority after all the losses that you've suffered at the state and local level over the last 8 years are almost breathtaking.
So the party really, I guess the good news is the party can sort of reconfigure itself in several different directions. They can go in an establishment direction a la Clinton, or they can go in a progressive direction a la Bernie Sanders, or they could try to counter Donald Trump with a direct appeal to those largely white blue-collar voters who abandoned the Democrats in 2016. Which direction do you think the party should go?
I don't think the party will necessarily go back. I think the party is going to go forward. The party is going to have a message that goes beyond, you know, we're just anti-Trump because he won the Electoral College. The party has to go beyond the resistance because he is the president of the United States and we oppose all of his policies. The party has to be an optimistic party. It has to choose hope and choose action. But more importantly, I think the future of the Democratic Party lies in not just its diversity, but it lies in the strength that our message is going to be compelling. There are kitchen table issues, and we're going to pick up the pieces that have been spread all over this country, and I think the party will come out stronger in 2018. It's going to be a tough year because the map looks as daunting as it has ever looked with so many seats up in the United States Senate, but mainly in quote-unquote so-called red states, North Dakota, Missouri, et cetera, Montana. We have to run credible, good, solid candidates with a strong message that resonates across the country, not just in one segment of the population, but across the entire country.
Do you think that the Democratic Party has adequately, shall we say, reckoned with what happened last year?
I think we have done a lot of work to rebuild, to retool. The evidence was obvious on November 7th across the country when Democrats picked up seats up and down the East Coast and all throughout the country, even in red states. I think the party can stand to learn the lessons of 2017 by remembering one thing, and that is grassroots mobilization from the bottom up, not top down. We got to stop focusing on Washington, D.C. and the Washington, D.C. beltway with the strategy of always paying consultants a big dollar for doing nothing but telling us what to do. Give it to the people. Let the people decide. Let the people down in Alabama decide what kind of future they want. Let the people of my beloved home state of Louisiana decide the future they want. If we can just get behind the people and stop, you know, looking at data and stop looking at polls, I think the country will be better off as well as the Democratic Party.
Donna, are you sure you don't want to rethink that idea about running for office?
No, I'm 57 years old.
Come on, come on.
I'll turn 58 next month. And for the first time in several years of my life, I'm looking forward to resting up over the holidays, spending Christmas with my family, the new year, and, you know, coming back to teaching. I love teaching. I'm very excited about the time I've spent here at Harvard. I look forward to getting back at Georgetown. I was just on the campus of Auburn University, LSU, just in the last 2 weeks, and I got so much more energy left in me to help this next generation of Americans. They're going to be the greatest generation. I know the millennials don't understand the future yet, but they are the future. They're the face of our future. They're the face of our democracy, and I'm excited about all of them.
Well stated. Last question for you before we let you go. You know, history teaches us that the party that wins the White House usually loses seats in the elections 2 years later, the midterms. And the Republicans have really done little to please the people who voted for them. So your party has a chance to take control of the House or the Senate or both. If Democrats take over the House, they seem likely to try and impeach Donald Trump. Would you support that effort? And if so, why?
Well, first of all, like I said, the map is tough. But I do think the Democrats are going to make up a lot of ground in state houses across the country, as well as make up a lot of ground in Congress. In terms of impeachment, I would hope that, and I know there's a lot of people out there saying impeach, impeach, impeach. Here's what I hope. I hope that the congressional investigation is completed within the you know, a reasonable timeline. I hope Director Mueller is completed, because nobody wants to continue to have these conversations of 2016 well into 2018 and beyond. But after we see the evidence, after we know everything, then I think we can make our own conclusions. I'm not one to jump to conclusions until we have all of the facts out there. Again, I pray for the president, because he is the president of the United States. I disagree with so many of his policies, as well as some of the tweets, his conversation. I would hope that the president would soon pivot. He's the president of the entire United States of America, not just one faction, not just one segment. But he needs to pivot. It's time for him to put down Twitter and to listen. Just listen. I mean, the American people are beautiful. The voices, even if you disagree, just listen to what people have to say and then make up your own mind. That's what I would hope. That's why I wanted to come on your show. That's why I wanted to let you know that anytime you want me to come on the show, I'm willing to, even if it's a tough conversation, because we can all use a dose of humility from time to time.
Well, I'm going to take you up on that. I guarantee you. Donna Brazile, a great American. Donna, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you, and please give my regards to your lovely wife as well. And let her know that whenever we're on the train together, we're going to celebrate all of the things that we share in common.
As we refer to our where we met on the train, that fateful day heading from Washington to New York, and it was a memorable train ride indeed. We had just talked about you in the cab on the way there, and we walk on the train, and who appears but Donna Brazile.
It was a lovely day. It was just meeting you two and sharing just a wonderful civil conversation. That's what it's like. I mean, we are Americans, and we may not be neighbors, but we should always just respect one another. And I thank you for allowing me this opportunity to talk to you and also to your listeners. I want to wish everybody the best of the best in this coming holiday season, whether you celebrate Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, whatever it might be, just know that there's joy in this season, and let us all find that joy in our lives.
Blessings to you, Donna. Thanks again.
Same to you, and bless you too.
That is Donna Brazile. Back in a flash with Talkin' Liberty.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
And now we welcome you into the portion of Liberty Nation, which we entitle Talkin' Liberty, which is self-explanatory, as we're joined by our regular contributor, constitutional lawyer and LibertyNation.com legal correspondent Scott Cosenza. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Tim.
Well, the Supreme Court agreed to hear three First Amendment cases in recent days. Could you give us a brief summary of what those three First Amendment cases are?
Yes, Tim. I think this is pretty important because of the potential import on First Amendment going forward. We have now a somewhat libertarian-ish court, it looks like, and the what we see going down the line could be a real swing. And so the first case has to do with a challenge to California law, crisis pregnancy center prescribed messages. So it's kind of interesting. Oftentimes we have pro-life people who are in opposition to state messages that encourage sort of pro-abortion messages. And now in this case, we have the opposite, which is the pro-life side. So people who are opposed to legal abortion have constructed these crisis pregnancy centers. And basically what they do is they try to convince young women usually to not have abortions, right? So they give them alternatives. They describe the development of the fetus, and hopefully they'll see sort of
and sometimes stuff that's far more graphic than that.
Certainly. Anyway, so some of that speech is prescribed by the state. So the state says you have to tell a person who comes into your crisis pregnancy center X, Y, and Z. They have sued and said that's an infringement on our free speech. I think it is an infringement. I think the state should not be allowed to prescribe either way, either for pro-abortion or anti-abortion. It should be hands-off. But anyway, it's an interesting case, and the Supreme Court has agreed to hear it. In the second case, Another fascinating case. This deals with retaliatory arrest and whether a retaliatory arrest can be an infringement on free speech, even if the underlying arrest was valid. So we see this, for instance, in many of these protest scenes where, if you're driving down the street, maybe you're going 26 in a 25, okay? But you have a bumper sticker on your car that says, "I hate," say, "I hate Trump," right? And it's a pro-Trump cop or a pro-Trump town, or the reverse is true. And they pull you over and give you a ticket for 26 and a 25, but the only reason why they did so was because of your political speech, right? So this case says, is that arrest even valid? Because without that speech, presumably, the arrest would not have been made. So that's another one. And the third one has to do with a ban on political apparel at the polls. Long ago, the Supreme Court said that it was permissible infringement on the First Amendment for governments to restrict politicking and campaigning at polls. And that has morphed in many jurisdictions into a total ban on political apparel. So you can't even wear, Trump for president t-shirt as you go to vote at the polls, or a Hillary for president t-shirt as you go to vote at the polls. The Minnesota Voters Alliance has challenged that ban as an impermissible restriction on free speech. And so we'll see how the court rules on all three. But I can tell you that the current status of the law on all three of those areas is on the sort of pro-government side. So just by taking those cases, it leads one to believe that maybe the court is going to trend in the opposite direction and return more sort of power to the people. But we'll see.
You mean become less deferential to the administrative state, which is really one of the major questions that kind of flies under the radar. By the way, I personally think, going back to the second case you referred to, that the repeated use of the word retaliatory is in itself an infringement on free speech because most people can't pronounce it.
Indeed.
All right. Hawaii, which registers guns and medical marijuana users, starts to disarm patients.
And this is one of those many troubling kind of things that has to deal with the tension between the various state and federal laws regarding marijuana use. And every buyer of a firearm at a federally licensed firearm dealer has to sign a paper that says that they're not an illegal user of marijuana. It actually says, all basically illegal drugs, but marijuana is listed on that. And you cannot be a legal user of marijuana in the United States according to the federal law. So even if you have a prescription from a doctor in a state that honors that prescription and allows that marijuana to be delivered to you without a problem, you are still in violation of the federal law. And Hawaii is actually using that now to take away guns from gun owners. Hawaii is notoriously the most hostile state, edging out New Jersey for
just
number
barely.
One anti-gun state. In
But it was a photo finish, was it not, Scott?
Yeah. Yeah. And so now they're, when these registries get started, both for guns and for marijuana, many libertarianish type people have said, do not join a government registry no matter what, because it inevitably will be used against you in some capacity.
Why would anybody want to volunteer to be in a government registry?
Well, if you live in Hawaii and want to own a gun legally, you have to be on their gun registry. And if you live in Hawaii and have a health condition that you think you'll benefit from the use of marijuana from, that's the only way for you to legally obtain and use marijuana. And the idea that, let's just think about this for a second, Tim. You could go to the store and buy a quart of whiskey every 3 hours while you're doing a prescription pain medication or antipsychotic medication, something just, off the charts, and you're fine and legal, and Hawaii doesn't care about you having a gun. Really, are marijuana smokers and medical marijuana users, is that really like where we need to go to the low-hanging fruit on the violence tree for firearms?
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Tim.
Scott Cosenza, legal correspondent for LibertyNation.com. Remember the podcast of this show, Liberty Nation Radio, as well as our own podcast, The Uprising, are available to you at LibertyNation.com, where truth is making a comeback. Also available on fine podcast providers everywhere. So that's it for this week, but we'll be back at you next week. Same time, same station. Till then, this is Tim Donner saying stand up for liberty. And we'll see you next time on Liberty Nation.